Welcome to Cruel Summer Book Club, a podcast about change, how we get through it, and what we learn on the other side. I'm your host, Jillian Anthony, author of the Cruel Summer Book Club newsletter, which is where I write about change in my own life. This week here in Austin, it's been mostly good. There's been a lot going on. First of all, I've had a cough for like two very long weeks. I've got that sweet summer cold that's going around that absolutely everybody has. About a week in, I did go get COVID tested just in case because of everything going on. I just wanted to make sure. And like any illness, you know, symptoms are basically COVID symptoms too. But it was negative. I was good to go. I just have an unbelievably long cough that, you know, I got because I'm, you know, been out and about more. So that's okay. I'm hopefully going to get better soon. I also have been on a couple of really fun first dates lately. There's just like the horniest summer energy you can imagine out here in Austin right now. It's really wild. And I went on a really particularly fun first date with this guy. He set all of our plans. He like fully led the entire conversation, asked me a ton of questions about myself, was like super attentive to me, remembered a lot of things about me. It was just so refreshing, such a rare experience for me. I loved it so much. And yeah, thank you. Thank you for lifting my spirits and renewing my faith in first dates a little bit. It was a lot of fun. Something I've been really obsessed with this week is Rambler Seltzer. So if you are a millennial listening, you are probably addicted to seltzer just like I am. And I've tried many, many different kinds now. I'm often having my first seltzer before 11 a.m. now. It's like, it's not great. It's getting pretty serious. But here in Texas, I tried for the very first time Rambler Seltzer. It's a Texas brand. I have never seen it when I was in New York or anywhere else. I'm not sure where you can find it. But I absolutely loved it. The grapefruit flavor, it's truly a superior seltzer. So if you guys care about this as much as I do, you know, give it a try, see for yourself. Send me your ratings 1 out of 10. I'm very curious. And this week for my homework for this episode, I read the book, The Ethical Slut, which my guest recommended I read. And so The Ethical Slut is, you know, it's a rather academic guide to all sorts of relationships and sexualities and ways of creating community outside of traditional heterosexual monogamy. So it's a really great education in all of that. And, you know, I've been personally interested in exploring non-monogamy myself for a long time. I'm really disillusioned by the imbalances present in heterosexual relationships, especially in marriage and what women often sacrifice within those relationships, but men don't. And the roots of marriage and monogamy are bound up in all sorts of patriarchal, anti-feminist systems that I don't subscribe to and don't want to be a part of. But I really do want to be in love. I really do want long-term partnership. So I feel I still have a lot of exploring to do to reconcile, you know, those desires for love and partnership alongside the kind of like bleak realities that are present in heterosexuality today. And I'd also really like to explore my own sexuality beyond what society and taught me and all of us pretty much growing up, which is like, you know, again, heterosexual monogamy, and you can either have a one night stand or marriage, and there's no intimacy to be found in between those two things. And I don't believe this at all. I really believe that I can demand and want to demand more for myself and more for my relationships. And I believe that no matter how long or short a connection lasts, whether it's sexual or emotional or both, it can be positive and even life-changing. And you can have something really important with someone, whether you're with them a month or a year or a day. I think the idea that the epitome of a woman's life being to find one perfect partner to be with forever, and I say that in air quotes, has seriously damaged me and like my outlook on life. All of those messages that have been drilled into me from when I was a very young age are not realistic. That ideology didn't prepare me for the realities of life, which is that almost all of our relationships, romantic or not, will end. And that loss and the coming together and falling apart of relationships is one of the only things that we can be absolutely sure of. So I really enjoyed reading The Ethical Slut, and I'm going to talk about it more with my guest today. But some of my main takeaways are: heteronormativity teaches us that love can only be shared with one person and that we must make ourselves and our sexualities small to have a successful long-term relationship. But The Ethical Slut asks you to imagine sex as a tool for pleasure and deep connection and community building, rather than a tool for power or ownership, which is what it's usually used as within, you know, traditional monogamous relationships. And I want that, and I want more love in my life and not less. And also, most of us simply just accept that monogamy is the only path because it was the only path taught to us. It is not the only path. And like many of the rest of the areas of my life that were socially drilled into me, I think it's my responsibility to critically examine all of the pathways for relationships that are open to me and then actively choose which one is right for me. I want to choose these things, not have them be handed to me. I'm always working on choosing my own happiness in whatever that means to me. And there are other paths and relationships that might make me more happy and might be more fulfilling to me, especially over a lifetime. And after reading the book and reading all their tips and tools to start pushing the limits of your own comfortability with non-monogamy, and they have all sorts of exercises and things you can do by yourself, things you can do with your partners, I still feel like pretty clueless about where to start and how to move myself in that direction. So that's something I'm going to have to work on, but I'm pretty sure radical honesties with any partners I have will be the very first step for me to continue to move myself along that path and like see what my limits might actually be. And I'm really, really excited to learn more about non-monogamy and happiness and partnership and all sorts of other things from my guests today. My guests today have been married for almost 12 years. They live in Seattle and they have two young daughters. Just so you know, we are using pseudonyms today to protect their identities because unfortunately there's still a lot of stigma around non-monogamy. So their pseudonyms for today are Soren and Mirabai. I went on a lunch date with Soren in Seattle in September. I was his fourth date since he and his wife decided to open up their marriage. And we've stayed in touch, and I really enjoyed learning more about their path to non-monogamy and how happy it's made both of them. So I'm so excited to welcome Soren and his wife Mirabai to talk to us about the very big change of opening up their marriage today. Welcome, you guys.
Thanks, Jillian. It's great to see you.
Yeah, we're delighted to be here.
Great to see you guys as well. And, you know, the first thing I always want to ask my guests just to kick us off is, what's your mood today? How are you feeling?
I'm feeling quite energized and very content, which is not always how I feel in the morning. But I had a wonderful long stretch of time in the mountains yesterday, and it's just beautiful weather and our kids are out of the house and we get to just sit and talk for a little bit about love and relationship, and I'm feeling good.
Yeah, I'm feeling pretty great too. It's high summer in Seattle, and that lifts my spirits. And yeah, I'm excited to have this conversation. I really started to love talking about polyamory and ethical non-monogamy. It's something that's I think been a hugely positive thing for us, and it feels cool to be able to share that with other people.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for being willing to share that. And you know, I feel like I've been interested in this for a while, but Soren, you really gave me a particular pathway to explore this more for myself. So I have to particularly thank you. Like, I'm so happy I am, and I'm so excited to learn more from you guys today.
Yeah.
And I'm happy that, you know, you're having a beautiful summer in Seattle right now and you know, joining me for this conversation. I feel like the first thing I want to hear about is if you could share your love story and how you met. You know, I always love hearing that story from couples.
Totally. That's a good one.
We really like sharing the story, and the full blown version is pretty stupendous, but we're going to give a shorter one.
Yeah,
for two
take
reasons.
Like an hour.
Yeah. We don't want to take up the whole episode with this, and it would include a lot of revealing details that would indicate that we're not really Soren and Mirabai. But we went to the same college in New England. I'm a year older, so we met at the very, very end of college, just as I was about to head abroad to do some volunteering for a couple years, and right before Soren here was about to do some backpacking. And so we ended up having, after meeting and kind of hitting it off very briefly at the end of college, we had about a year of pretty epic and very intimate romantic correspondence via handwritten letters and emails that were going back and forth to these different countries that we were in at the time.
Yeah, I mean, she didn't have email where she was, really. And so we kind of needed to do the handwritten letters thing. And a phone call would cost like $80. I'm not joking. I spent a lot of money on phone calls.
And after about a year of this, Soren showed up in the extremely remote, almost like off the map place where I was living, and kind of surprised me and sort of swept me off my feet. And mm-hmm. we began our courtship at that point and ended up traveling around a lot together. We spent some time in northern India and came back to the States, went to grad school at the same place, and got married during grad school. So for the sake of this conversation, what's relevant is that we have known each other since 2004, and we have been together, and until this was no longer the case, we were monogamous for about 15 years.
And maybe one little other feature mm-hmm. is that when we met, we were both dating other people. There was that barrier. It wasn't like a major part of it all, but I think there was a little barrier to that, and we started flirting a lot.
Yeah, it allowed a friendship to pre-exist the romance. We really did kind of, a lot of that correspondence was actually fairly platonic. There was lots of flirting, but we were really just getting to know each other very, very well before there was any explicit talk of, do you like me? Do I like you?
Yeah, there was never nothing overtly sexual. It was always flirty in terms of just turning up the energy.
That's very romantic. I haven't heard a modern telling of letter writing campaign to prove love in a long time.
Yeah. It did the trick for both of us.
It was great. We still have them. Every now and then we pull one out and read it, mm-hmm. remember what we were like back then.
Yeah, that's lovely. So as you were together, got married, were monogamous this entire time, I just want to hear a little bit about the ideals you were raised with as far as how you thought about relationships and monogamy.
Well, two things come to mind right now. And these are both thick in the air that we breathe and the water that we all drink by virtue of living in the West today. And so the first is that for me, I had always internalized, as many people did, that any relationship that's romantic is on an escalator and it progresses to certain levels. And it's supposed to do that. And it does it in a particular order with maybe some very few socially sanctioned exceptions. So you meet someone, you start dating exclusively, and then you decide that you, after a while, things are going great, then you get engaged and then you get married and then you move in together and then you have babies. And then who knows what happens after that. But that's sort of like these tiers that you're supposed to progress to with a relationship. And if things are going well, you're supposed to move up the escalator in that order in a fairly steady state. And so we kind of had that pretty traditional unfolding of our relationship. You know, we met, we became friends, we dated right away. It was exclusive because we weren't into sort of dating many people at the same time. We got engaged soon after we got married. We moved out to Seattle. We had babies. We bought a house. Oh, you fit that into the mix.
Following the script.
Yeah. So the script is really strong, and it took forever for me to even recognize it as a script, that this was something that was offered as the way that you enter into early adulthood and move through it with regards to romance and partners. And that has been utterly dismantled recently. And then the second thing that also, whether or not a listener identifies as religious, and in my case, growing up with a lot of Christian influence, Christianity is the hegemonic religious tradition of our society. So we all internalize its norms, often unconsciously. And in my case, that included an awful lot of repression around sex and sexuality. So I know this isn't unique to me, but like many others, I grew up feeling as though there was a lot about sex that was taboo, was kind of dirty / sacred, and sacred in a way that it was only meant to be shared with one person forever and ever. And also, I had an experience in a youth group in high school where everything was about intercourse. That was the ultimate evil thing that you couldn't do, but you could sort of do everything up to that point. So
no P in the V.
There's no P in the V was allowed. So
just a quick interjection. That just reminded me of in college, one of my sorority sisters was a virgin, but she had anal sex with her boyfriend.
There's a great video. What is it called? It's some kind of like, fuck me in the ass because I love Jesus. that's the name of this YouTube video. It's hilarious. Check it out.
Anyway, sorry for interrupting. Please continue.
That's all right. I mean, those are the two things that just came to mind this morning that were deeply, deeply internalized for me as we arrived at this point of wanting to all of a sudden start questioning that and many other things.
Yeah, I totally relate to both of those influences. And then just in my own family, I grew up with a very happy household where my parents appeared to be deeply in love and everything was great and it was like unshakable. And that became the ideal for me. It's like you find the one at a young age because they got married in college. And then you have this kind of idyllic life. Now that came crashing down when they got divorced right after I went to college. And I was like, oh, maybe there was more to it. And I didn't see that. And so that was that kind of shook things for me. But I was still raised for all those years with this notion of finding the one and it lasts forever.
So sounds like you were both on similar pages as far as, you know, the mindset you went into this relationship and marriage with. So when did your thoughts on marriage and monogamy start evolving and how did you broach the subject together?
You know, I remember even when we were dating, maybe we just got engaged or something like that. And we did have a little conversation about like, man, we're really young and we have had very little sexual experience. It's great that we're in love and we're getting married, but like, it's a little sad. Maybe someday we'll have to shake things up. So we were kind of vague about it, but we did broach that even back then while we still had these influences.
Yeah. And I think that we both, from a variety of life experiences and I think what we were studying at the time, were primed for sort of an open-minded outlook on the world and on life, sort of recognizing that we operate within a certain discourse, but there's other discourses where things are different and the things that we assume to be right and true and good and bad could be completely different in another discourse. And so I think that we were both ready to just imagine other possibilities. Mm-hmm. And add this into the context that we were walking a fairly unconventional path already. So without getting into too many details about our careers and whatnot, we're not really in a mainstream typical career. I think we've always been willing to kind of follow our values and follow heart callings academically, professionally, and increasingly just in the way that we live out our day-to-day life. And so when that gaze was sort of cast upon our marriage, ultimately, it wasn't too hard to entertain unorthodox and atypical paths, because we'd already done that with what we chose to study, how we chose to work. Early on, we kind of took a really critical look at our money. Like, where is our money going and how does it align with our values? And we ended up making some big changes. We ended up switching banks and, you know, changing around some investments and purchasing differently. And it was all for the sake of kind of aligning our money, which I always think of as every dollar you spend is a vote that you're casting, aligning that with our values. And we had never applied all of that to our marriage. So when it came time to do that, we had some experience to draw from.
Yeah. So we had exposure and access and the privilege to be thinking about these kind of bigger, different questions and value systems. And then moving to Seattle, which is a place full of creative people who are often trying to live life differently. Of course, there's a lot of conformity here too, but there's a real openness to living a bit differently.
Okay. That's so perfect. When we first moved to Seattle, we had some dear friends from back east move in with us for a short amount of time. And while we were living together, they announced that they were now polyamorous. And we watched them kind of from the sidelines enter into this new life experience. And we were right there by their side through all of the bumps and struggles and like communication mishaps and trickiness, and also through like the joys and the unfolding discoveries and whatnot. And I think that more than anything else, we knew that this was possible. Sometimes it just takes witnessing someone else operating in a certain way or behaving a certain way to recognize that something's possible, instead of just reading about it abstractly in a book or listening to a podcast and someone else's story. Like, these are dear friends, and here they were doing it, and they were doing it well.
Yeah, and they never pushed it. I mean, that's part of the reason we're doing this podcast, I think, is that it's, you know, just sharing your story, and somebody might feel a little bit liberated by that being an option. So they never pushed it. They never have. But over the years, we've kept in, we're still friends with them, and just being able to see that unfurl. And we'd always ask a ton of questions to them. And at one point, they're like, y'all are pretty curious about all this. Maybe you should think why you're so curious about all this. And we're like, yeah.
And I think it didn't take long after that for us to be like, this is really indeed something that we are curious about and open to. But then enter babies into the picture. Mm-hmm. And that just delayed the whole experience for us by several years, because during pregnancy, early parenting, and we've got two kids, so this ended up being a big swath of a couple of years. It was about survival. And it was this, it was not the right time to embark on this. Our marriage kind of struggled during that time. We were both sleep deprived. I don't think either of us really loves parenting little tiny babies. I feel like we're just now kind of entering more of the parenting phase that suits our personalities a bit better.
Play chess now.
And so for several years, we knew that it was not the right time to embark on this. We needed to kind of focus on just making it through each day and each week and each month.
So that kind of slowed down. Then we just got to the point of wanting to do it, feeling like the time was right.
Oh, and we hit our 10-year wedding anniversary. And Soren here and I are both very oriented towards ritualizing and ceremonializing things in life. We really like marking the passage of time in meaningful ways. We like creating rituals and ceremonies. And so our 10-year anniversary was no exception. And we kind of paused to say, all right, it's been 10 years. You know, 10 years ago, we were in this place with these people around us at this point in life. And we made these vows to each other in the presence of all of these folks. And now, where are we? Like, how is our marriage now? We're in a different place. We have different jobs. Our immediate community is similar in some ways, but there's many new people. And we've got 10 years under our belt of being in love and living together. What would vows look like now if we were to say, I still choose you. I still want to be married to you. What does the commitment look like now? And that ceremony, we ended up pulling a whole bunch of people together and writing these new vows. And we went off into the woods and we had this like lovely weekend long party. It was kind of ended up being like a second wedding. It was great fun. And the intention was not to like secretly ritualize a transition into polyamory. No. It was really about recalibrating our marriage at that point and reinviting our new community of people to be witnesses and supporters of our marriage at that time. But what that invited was an awful lot of deep introspection into how are we doing? What do the next 10 years look like? In what ways are we honoring one another's flourishing and one another's dreams, and what could be different? And so I think that really ultimately opened the gate wide open for us to spring into these conversations with sort of a zeal and an earnestness that hadn't been there before.
So yeah, there was all those things. I mean, and there was also, we should be honest about it, like, you know, long-term relationship. Has its ebbs and flows of passion and desire and all of this. So we didn't enter, I mean, I've talked to a lot of people who are polyamorous, and many of their stories come from like, things weren't working, so we had to try this. Or I had these kinks that my partner didn't have, and so I needed to have an outlet for that. And I don't think our foray into this was primarily motivated by a lack. It was mostly by a seeking of greater abundance and like expanding our love rather than trying to save what we had. And there's like an element of reality that it is hard to maintain deep passion and commitment and over many, many years. In some ways, we approached this from an idea of maybe this will, in addition to helping us as individuals flourish, be something that feeds our relationship, which most people find to be kind of counterintuitive. They think it would be, this is a threat to your relationship. This is going to cause some dings. And is our relationship strong enough to handle the slings and arrows of polyamory? And we really approached it from a much more optimistic point of view of this could enhance our love and our desire and our commitment
Yeah. And we recognized it as a risk, and it was a risk we were willing to take. Yep. I mean, at the time, and we can talk more about this later, at the time, it was sort of like, well, we could just always go back to being monogamous if we want to, but we might as well try this out. I'm not sure at this point we feel that way still. But we've always been open to having an element of risk in our lives. I think we're kind of primed that way.
So what were some of the very first steps that you took to actually make this a reality for your relationship?
Well, we both read The Ethical Slut that you have recommended to your readers. Yes. We ended up reading it right around the same time. And we were in a cabin out by Mount Rainier. And this was in the winter. I think it was right around New Year's. And we ended up both out of the reading of this book and several other, you know, podcasts, other resources we had ingested. We ended up writing down, each of us, our feelings, our justification for this. And they turned into kind of a sort of a declaration that we ended up saying to each other on the shore of this frozen lake on New Year's Eve of 2019. And I can share a little bit about what's in there if we want to. But that ended up, again, you know, we're kind of into these little rituals. So that was a moment. That was a moment where we said, okay, before was then, and now something new is beginning from this moment onwards. And we ended up taking off our wedding rings in that moment. And it wasn't intended to be a grand symbolic gesture. It was more out of curiosity. It's like, I wonder what it might feel like to go around without a wedding ring. And for neither of us, the ring was all that important. We bought them off of a street vendor in Indonesia for like $12, like a week before we got married. But it was sort of like, what, I wonder if it will feel differently to go around without this, you know, public symbol of kind of
being taken,
like being owned by someone else. For me, it turned out to make almost no difference at all, it seemed, either for how I felt or for how others treated me. But it was just sort of like, this is a little gesture we can make to indicate that now something's different.
Yeah, we weren't unmarrying ourselves. We just were challenging the symbolism of the ring, which is a little bit of a sense of being possessed by somebody else. And so for me, a big part of polyamory is the spirituality of non-possession and non-ownership and non-control of another person's body. So I consider myself an intersectional feminist bro. And I just, you know, really think that our heteronormative marriage in this country and is rooted in patriarchy and capitalism, and the control of primarily women's bodies. Yeah, I just don't want to keep participating in that unconsciously. I'm not saying that every monogamous marriage is like that, but there is a way in which monogamy is compulsory by virtue of there not being any other option presented to people. And so Dr. Kim Tallbear, who's kind of one of the patron saints of polyamory for us, she's an indigenous scholar, part of the Lakota people, I believe, and writes a lot about polyamory. She had a blog for many years called The Critical Polyamorist, where she anonymously blogged about her poly experience. And it's online, and I'd highly recommend it. She's on a few different podcasts. One is All My Relations, which is two First Nations women discussing a lot of topics. And on episode 5, Kim Tallbear is speaking with them about sex.
Yeah, if anything tipped the scales for us, it was episode 5 of All My Relations with Dr. Kim Tallbear.
Yes, it wasn't due like 8 times.
It's called Decolonizing Sex, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I just listened to it like a week ago, so I love that.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I think I sent it to you after our date in Seattle, too.
Oh, I did not listen to it then. A friend of mine just sent it to me recently, but I found her to be absolutely fascinating. And yeah, I would also recommend that to anyone, but I look forward to reading more of her work. But yeah, please continue.
Yeah. So this kind of non-possession thing. So the ring was kind of connected to that. I mean, it wasn't a central feature, but I'm just using it as a springboard into this discussion of like, what does it mean to appreciate Mirabai in my life? And be grateful that she shares herself and her time with me, and not need that to be something I take for granted as it only is meaningful if only I get to have it. I can just be grateful that she shares it with me. But it's her body, and it's her life, and it's her time, and it's her energy. I actually feel like closer because of that. You know, we have to really ask why we're doing this and choose each other and feel chosen rather than, well, it's my only option. The other option is the very complicated legal, financial, socially stressful thing of divorce. There's another way.
So this thing, everything she was talking about, was one of the sort of the five things ended up coalescing into these sort of categories. And this is one we called the sharing ethic. Can I just read this?
Sure.
This is my version of sort of the vow or the declaration around sharing that I wrote that night at the cabin. I wrote, "I do not need to possess, own, or control another, particularly their creative power, sexual energy, spiritual energy, because the erotic is so personal and mysterious and has been repressed for so long. You are a divine being that I delight in and give thanks for, and especially that we are one another's chosen one. May this journey make us more in love, more awake, more good to ourselves, more generous, more liberated, and more liberating."
Pretty cool, huh?
Yes, very cool.
I won't read them all right now, but the other sort of coalescing categories were honoring desire. And a lot of that was a direct address of the sort of repression that we had all internalized, especially from our religious upbringing. So embracing that pleasure is good and wanting to just honor that very reality. A sense of just sort of fun and adventure, the idea that life is abundant and full of novelty and possibilities, and that we wanted to honor richness and new rhythms to the dance of life. Honoring sexual growth and evolution, and just recognizing that there's an awful lot of sexual repression that in our lives and in our backgrounds, and a lot of room for self-exploration and self-actualization. And tending to our bodies, including the desires that we have. And then finally was what Soren was referring to earlier, just about the writing on the wall with long-term monogamous relationships. And Esther Perel has done a lot of really good writing on this. But the statistics regarding Eros in long-term monogamous relationships are not very promising. And we're really committed to seeking out flourishing and passion and health in our relationship in the real intention that it lasts a lifetime. And so this was a desire to kind of bring greater longevity, more joy, more passion, more love and commitment into our marriage.
Yeah, that's an incredible list of, you know, shared values moving forward. As part of, you know, you guys opening up your relationship, I'm sure that you also had specific conversations about, you know, this is a list of agreed upon things between the two of us that, you know, we're going to embrace or not embrace as we go on this journey. So is that a different list, or does that kind of, did those things also fall under these categories?
We sketched out this philosophical approach quite in detail, as you can hear. And there's even more to it, but we're not going to burden your listeners with our academic nerddom anymore. But we did a lot with that, and we did very little around practical rules. And we have very few practical rules. Honesty and openness is probably the one and only thing that we have. So, I know people who said, okay, for a while, like, here are the physical boundaries and limits that we're going to engage in, and we'll kind of wade into things like that, like just above the neck or whatever, you know, for a while, and then you kind of get used to it and say, okay, well, let's see where we go from here. We didn't do really any of that, and we still don't have any rules other than honesty. We have some safe sex.
Yeah.
Agreements.
Yeah. That, of course, was sort of a new terrain to wander into and be careful about. Similarly, we know of other couples, for example, who might have started out saying, I get to read all of your text messages with other people just for total transparency. And from the very beginning, that felt uncomfortable, not because I imagine there being an awful lot that I would want to hide and keep private or that Soren would, but just because I think we have really like profound and deep trust in one another. I think we really felt secure that our honest, open, frequent conversations about how all this is going would be sufficient. And we didn't really need to, it just felt like an extension of the control that we were trying to move away from. So we don't have a lot of rules, which is not to say that there aren't some we could have, and that there aren't rules and boundaries that have been very helpful for a lot of couples as they've maneuvered into this terrain. For us, that didn't quite feel right. It was just a lot of checking in and adjusting and sharing and imagining and more sharing and feeling our way through this terrain together.
There's an Instagram and Patreon poly sort of figure named Shrimp Teeth, which I always found to be kind of a grotesque name, but she talks about like the desire with boundaries to control a partner in some way, and how an alternative to that is just really being in touch with what you need and asking for that from the relationship that you're in. So rather than seeing, okay, my partner has another partner and they're really into them, and so I'm going to say, hey, you can only see them once a week, and no, any more than that is too much or something. You can say, I miss spending time with you. I want more time with you. You know, that is an approach to talk about you and your needs and your relationship rather than I'm threatened by your freedom and I need you to not fully express that. So I think we started out in a healthy way with that.
Yeah.
That.
But plus one to shrimp teeth.
That makes so much sense. It's about, you know, just as far, same thing with dealing with emotions and what you can control, right? It's like, bring it back to you. And it's okay, you know, why am I reacting this way? What do I need from this situation? What can I and can I not control? And, you know, putting that out in a healthy way. And I also love that you guys came from such a place of trust together, because from everything that I have read and people I've talked to about this, the trust and communication, you know, that's not just a cliche. That's truly what makes it work. And without that, you know, the actual ethical non-monogamy part of it and you keeping your relationship with each other strong, it's not going to work. So that's really amazing to hear. And since, you know, since you guys did decide to open up your marriage, you have both gone on dates, of course, and also had other partners, external partners. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about that and how you've navigated that and what you've learned along the way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we entered into this really thinking it would be a long time before we got into more emotionally entangled relationships, to be honest. We figured like, all right, let's sort of have some adventure, and neither of us have time for
it. Yeah, it was like a bandwidth thing. We're like, we're parents and we have full-time jobs and we're managing all this stuff in our lives. Like, there's no time for a lover. And so we had just both assumed that there would be a lot of dating here and there, have some sex, have some flirting, and that would just be like a little sprinkle to our lives. But lesson number one is we're not always in control of this process.
Nope.
And so I think early on for both of us, we had this, you know, you embark on this and then sometimes unexpected things happen and you meet someone and all of a sudden there's feelings there and you realize that you really want to have a intimate kind of romantic connection in addition to just like another friend or like a sex partner. And so that happened to both of us, not exactly at the same time, but kind of right around the same time, and was unexpected. And we honored it. We made room for it.
Yeah, it was a big growing curve for a big learning curve and a big growth curve for us very quickly with all of this to manage all those internal feelings that come up when your beloved is feeling love for someone else. And wanting to spend time with them and getting that NRE, which is new relationship energy, which is like a drug. I mean, it's so delicious and exciting. And, you know, if you are too into a comparative mindset, you can contrast that with your relationship and say, well, you know, we don't do those things anymore, have those kind of passionate moments. But it's, I think for both of us, it's pushed us on that and said, we need to generate those things in our relationship.
Yeah, I got some really great advice from this sage older person early on who said, every time you kind of have this little burst of like NRE with this new person, or you have a wonderful date, or you have like amazing sex, see if there's something you can bring back from that into your marriage. And so if I would have like a really fun kind of flirty text exchange, I would pause and take a moment to like send a fun flirty text as well. Mm-hmm. So that it wouldn't feel like all my flirting, you know, spoons are now going to this person and I have none left for my husband. It's like, there's abundance. There's so much abundance here. I'm getting a lot of great energy here. I got more to give. I'm going to give some back here as well.
Yeah. I found that to be the case too, that my like erotic energy has been enhanced by polyamory rather than spread thin. It's not like I have this very small limited bandwidth of that. There's time and there's mostly time that is a finite resource, but in terms of passion and even sexual energy, it's like increased. And so I have more to give rather than less to draw from.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And that's exactly what, you know, I would like to think and hope about if I ever explored this more. It's like, I think there's more, not less. And so I love to hear that that's been your experience. And you guys mentioned a couple of times scheduling and time, right? I think that's my number one question when I'm thinking about this. So, you know, one thing to be married and then to be dating, I'm single and dating and it takes up time, you know, but then also to be married. Oh, and you have two kids, of course. And then also to be married and have a whole other, like genuinely, romantic supportive relationship where you are putting your emotional energy and time into this person. So I'd love to hear about the schedules you have worked up. Cause I've heard a little bit that, you know, you have told me before, Soren, that a particular night of the week is reserved for date night for you guys. And there might be another night of the week that's reserved for your girlfriend. So please tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So, scheduling is a big part of our life, but it always has been because we've always lived fairly independent lives. And that's one thing that's made this somewhat of an easy transition for us. We've never been like, hey, I'm going to this party. You have to come because you're my wife. So I can't go without you. We've always had very free agent kind of schedules. But that means we have to communicate about all that. So we're used to that process and it's a very kind of healthy and matter of fact one. But yeah, we sit down every week and kind of sketch things out. We have a date night as a standard thing every week. And I have a date night with my girlfriend every week. And then beyond that, we just touch base with each other about what's going on.
It's not simple or easy, but we have the tools to be able to manage it. And I'm also sort of wondering how much of sort of polyamory among like white middle upper class people seems like there's a lot of sort of fixation on the schedule as like the main part of it that's challenging. And I think I don't want to lose sight of
that's part of, I mean, Kim Tolliver talks about that, things like that, you know, but it is a real factor of how do you manage the finite resource of time, because this is a philosophy of abundance, right? It's like, oh, you can have more love and more connection and all this. And there are external factors. I think those come to head in the calendaring feature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that, you know, another unique part of your situation is that you have two kids. I mean, a lot of people that are doing this also have kids. And I think that's another common question that people are like, how does that work? And what's that like? So as much as you're comfortable with, you know, how do you talk about non-monogamy with your kids if you do at all? And, you know, another question I had was, you know, the book, The Ethical Slut, talks a lot about how these relationships that they're having with multiple people often become a really serious village and community. that helps them raise their kids, that everybody knows each other and loves each other. And yes, there might be sexual connections, but it's very emotional and community oriented as well. So I was wondering if that's entered into your life in any way.
Well, from the moment we moved out to Seattle, we have been invested in creating a community. In fact, that was part of Soren's professional objective, was to create community. And so our children have grown up with kind of a village around them long before we became polyamorous. They're used to people showing up at the house and hanging out for a while, like, you know, random new people at the dinner table, you know, this person's going to drop you off at school today. And this was just kind of part of the way that we were living our life. I don't even know how many people have keys to our house at this point. We've always had housemates and roommates. So we haven't really been into the sort of like protection of the nuclear family as the four of us for a while. So in that sense, this wasn't a dramatic shift. It's like, oh, there's lots of other grown-ups, aunties and uncles in their lives.
And kids, yeah.
And other kids in their lives. And this is just an extension of that. The fact that some of them are sexual partners didn't really feel like it was an important thing at this age to have a explicit sit-down conversation with them about.
We did talk to them early on and said, at least I remember having this conversation, I said, do you girls think it's like you can really only love one person, or can you love like more than one? And they were like, more than one. I said, do you think you should just like hug and kiss one person, or more than one? And they're like, more than one.
It's leading the witness.
And I was, no, I think it's a really bad question. And I was like, I don't know what else there is to say, honestly. Like, it's kind of that basic.
We don't lie to them.
No.
We also, they're little and they don't need to know all of the details about our lives. And
they don't want to.
So, you know, this is, they're kind of growing up with this. I think it's going to feel normal and not like a sudden change in norms or behaviors. And we also are very comfortable talking to them pretty honestly from an early age about things in life. You know, when the second child was born, the elder knew that like a baby comes out of the vagina and you know, we're familiar with like how sex works and how children come into the world. And this isn't something that I think we've ever felt a strong need to kind of sugarcoat or downplay or ignore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have some, you know, dreams of living in kind of a co-housing situation and all that. It doesn't have to be polyamorous centric, but that is part of our kind of values and dreams for the future. And that would mesh very well.
Yeah, that's great. Sounds like age appropriate learning, like any parent is trying to do. And also, you know, being open, honest about sexuality, which not all parents are trying to do. So good for you. I wanted to ask though, you know, as I mentioned, we're using pseudonyms today. I just wanted you to kind of explain a little more why you wanted that and why you feel like there might be some dangerous judgments from you being public about your non-monogamous status.
It is still something that we're kind of getting used to in a way. I mean, we've been doing this for a while. We talked about it for years. So I think we're very comfortable internally with it. But just remembering back when those friends of ours shared this with us like 10 years ago, it was like, whoa, that is weird.
Even more recent than that, I had some friends about 2 or 3 years ago share this news. And on the outside, I said and did all the right things. I was like, that's wonderful. I'm so happy for you. Like, what an exciting evolution. Like, I'm here to support you. But inside, still, I was like, whoa, this is weird. So just remembering that those are normal reactions, that there's still a lot of judgment. It's very normal for there to be judgment because we still live in the world we live in. We still remember what the sort of the water and the air is like around this. This is pretty marginal.
Now in Seattle, I mean, there's tens of thousands of people probably who are practicing some form of ethical non-monogamy. And so it's nice to be out here or in, you know, Brooklyn or in LA, San Francisco, Portland, Denver. There's cities with large pockets. I don't know. Is Austin, are there many ENM people out there? ENM means ethical non-monogamy.
I definitely think so. I have a friend who I have been having these kind of conversations with about, who's kind of in like a very sex positive community here. So I would very much assume that Austin is much like all of those other liberal fantastical cities.
So it's been nice being here where there's a much higher consciousness of it, but it's still stigmatized, and we feel a need to sort of maintain a little bit of control over people's understanding and knowledge of our sexual life.
Yeah, we really value the opportunity to tell those who are close to us and dear to us at the sort of time and place and manner of our choosing. So if at all possible, we have been trying to share this news with our friends and to some degree with our family, but it's really lovely to be able to kind of choose the time and place and manner of sharing that news. And in person is really ideal. And due to the pandemic, there's been hardly any opportunities for that.
Yeah.
So not a lot of people know. And we're just sort of carefully maneuvering towards sharing this news with them as it feels right.
People can feel threatened by it, you know? Like maybe we won't have time for them anymore because we're going to be busy dating and all this. Or like, what does that mean for their partnership and their marriage?
Yeah.
And there's a lot that can come up for people with it. And so we want to be having that conversation gently. Mm-hmm. That's a big part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also Soren here is something of a public figure in Seattle. And the community is one that this would not really be like a scandal if it came out, but it would probably be drama that we just don't really need in our lives at the moment.
Yeah, I understand. Of course, there is still stigma. Of course, it's your personal information to share as you will. But I think like what I think about most, again, I haven't experienced this personally, but it very often tends to be women who will suffer professionally from an announcement like this. I'm sure men as well, but you know, I think that for me, if I, you know, let's say I was going to announce, you know, this is my life now, that would be something I definitely have to think really hard about, because I know that would, yeah, there's a lot that can affect your career if you talk about sex in any way.
Yeah, it's a very asymmetrical kind of threat. Based on your gender. So I do recognize that I've got some privilege with that. And it's, you know, it's almost assumed that like men want that and are that way. Mm-hmm. But oddly, you know, the statistics are from, I think, the general world and from people I've talked to anecdotally, that it's often in a heterosexual relationship, the woman who brings it up. When it's like, who brought this up? That's often a question people want. It's often a woman in a relationship. And I remember talking to our therapist, who said that this is a couple of years ago, that when people become open their marriage, it's more likely that the woman will develop emotional attachment feelings and want to like leave the relationship rather than the man. So I don't know if that contributes to the conversation, but I found that kind of interesting.
Yeah. Well, that probably also just has to do with imbalances in marriage between genders in general. So that's interesting. And I was just thinking, you know, I didn't ask you guys where and how exactly you have been meeting people you've been going on dates on. Soren, we met on an online dating app. I believe it was Tinder at the time. But just a little funny tidbit that I wanted to share with you guys from The Ethical Slut. So I read a 2017 version of the book, which is still, I would say, like extremely outdated. Like it doesn't mention online dating once. But I was laughing so hard because it talked about how if you want to meet polyamorous people, you should go to the Renaissance Fair because that's where they all are.
Yeah, we're actually going this weekend to the Renaissance Fair.
Not to meet people.
No way.
Because our kids want to dress up and...
Yeah, no, I love the fair.
That's so funny.
I mean, it makes sense that that would be a thing. There's a lot of very nerdy poly people. It's like...
Yeah, actually, and on that note, I mean, we're sort of like... I'm like a vintage nerd, and we have sort of like threads of like academic nerddom in us, but we're not burners, and we're not sort of deep into like
computers and stuff.
Yeah. And it's true. Like for whatever reason, this subculture seems really disproportionately populated with people who would self-identify as nerds.
And yeah. It's not a pejorative or negative thing. It's people are like, yeah, we're nerds, woo! Which is great. I love it.
But, but it does mean that what we're looking for is a smaller subset of the subculture. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But no, to your question, Julian, we are new to dating apps because those didn't, we weren't using those, and often many of them didn't exist when we got together. So we kind of entered into this world very recently. We had a good friend come over and we were like, how does these work? What are they like? And she was like, Bumble is like this and Tinder is like this and OkCupid is like that. And she was kind of walking us through the various ways that they work and the pros and cons. And we just kind of had to like dive in and try. It was really like literally one day we were like, let's just make a profile on an app. And so we both did. We like shared it with each other. We're like, is this a good picture of me? Should I describe myself in this way?
Yeah, and it was actually very intimate.
It was fun. And then we just kind of launched. And within like a day, we had matched with each other on Bumble. We started flirting on
Bumble. That's so very sweet.
It's mostly apps. And we're just very, very clear. We both say on our profiles, we are in, you know, happy, non-possessive marriages. Or we say ENM or kitchen table poly. We just are very, very clear. There's no hiding this. And there's a lot of folks out there that that are in the same boat.
I've been on a lot of dates with women who are like really curious and they want to learn more about it. So they're like, can we go on a date and I can ask, I can pick your brain sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I love talking about it. So.
And without these apps, I mean, I really don't know what we would have done. This thought crossed my mind. I was like, everyone we know knows us as a married monogamous couple, and I don't know what are we supposed to be like, go to a bar together and be like, we're together but we're totally open to like hang out and flirt with other people? How do you navigate that terrain? It was a total mystery. So it's just been all about meeting people on apps, which is really fun.
I like that bar idea though.
I gotta say, one of the things that I've just loved so much is meeting new people. There's all these wonderful new people. And I love getting to know someone for the first time. I love asking the questions. I love sharing about myself. I love telling stories. I love the encounter with a new person. I used to interview professionally. And it's such a fun thing to sort of have this small amount of time and try and like bring out interesting things about someone. And so I think it at times it gets a little weary, and I don't doubt that it'll sort of wear off at some point. But for now, it's just wonderful. And when we were in this monogamous heterosexual marriage, it felt like it was very, very hard to meet guys that I just wanted to be friends with. And you know, increasingly, my male friends sort of drifted away, and friendships were mostly with other couples. And so this has been a really lovely kind of bonus of this whole thing, is I feel like I have guy friends back in my life, and I love having guy friends.
Yeah, I think that's a really common thing. I think that from my married couple friends, that very much tends to happen. And there tends to be like a line drawn between like, oh, well, now I can no longer have friends of the opposite gender, which is very interesting and sad. But yes. That's really interesting. I'm so glad that dating has been so fun for you guys. I'm also loving it. I feel like if I had taken, you know, 15 years off of dating, I definitely would love it. So I can imagine how much fun it is for you.
Yes, it's extraordinarily fun.
Something I always ask my guests is, what was a piece of art of any medium that helped you guys through a hard time in your lives? Perhaps The Ethical Slut was one of those. I don't know. But a book, a podcast, a movie, anything like that.
Reiterate my love for that podcast with Dr. Kim Talbert on All My Relations. Mm-hmm. She's also interviewed on For the Wild and talks a little bit more about nature connection and the legal aspects of patriarchy, capitalism, and marriage in the United States, and the marginalization of indigenous people. So those are really great. That's very academic stuff. In terms of just like a heart, like helps me emote and whatnot. There's a great song by Darling Side and some guy with an Irish name called The Parting Glass. It's like a 3-minute. Kind of sounds like a sea shanty. I think I've listened to it like 200 times this year. And whenever I'm deep in my feels.
Sea shanties were big this year.
Yes. And I was in it.
How about you, Mirabai?
Well, I'll just share two things. So the first is this book I found off the shelf that is called Wild Mercy by Mirabai Starr, hence my pseudonym for today. And she's a woman mystic living in New Mexico. And this book has been a very inspiring tome for me on for healing and for finding joy and finding inspiration from spiritual women's voices. But since Soren here mentioned a song, I wanted to also just share, I got really into this practice called interspiritual meditation recently, and I also got into the idea of connecting music to this particular kind of meditation. And deep in the pandemic, I was sort of collecting songs that to me had no percussion and no lyrics, and were simply expressing a lot of what I was feeling at that time. The one that I'll toss out there, which is actually a little bit more of sort of an uplifting and hopeful one, is just one of my favorites, and it's called Franz and the Eagle, and it's by Yo-Yo Ma and Stuart Duncan and Edgar. It's from the Goat Rodeo Sessions, Edgar Meyer and Chris Thiele. It just makes me feel like soaring.
So Franz and the Eagle's the track name. My track name is The Parting Glass by Henry Jameson, featuring Darling Side.
Lovely. I will have to look both of those up and listen to them. And also, what is a joy bomb in your life? So what is a self-care practice that you guys both consistently practice that brings you joy and peace in your life?
I don't know about consistently, but I had a major joy bomb yesterday, just hiking on Mount Rainier. I did a 19-mile hike by myself, and it was exactly what I needed. Slightly more regularly would be just swimming in the lake, just jumping and doing a swim workout in Lake Washington.
Yeah, for me, I meditate most days, and it really is centering. It's not a bomb of joy, but it's kind of like a joy luge. I would say it's kind of consistent, smooth thing does that make any sense?
Yeah.
That kind of smooths out the turbulence of the day into a more laminar flow, which is good. And then joy, like a bigger burst for me, is when I can cut out the time to do some creative writing. And it's painful at the start, and it feels good.
I love everything you guys shared with me today, all the beautiful habits you've built together and by yourselves. I am really inspired by the honesty you share with each other, clearly the joy and connection you guys have. So thank you guys so much for coming today and sharing everything with me and with so many people that I think are going to learn a lot from our conversation.
Yeah, thank you for having us. This has been a lot of fun. It's felt good to share this with you. We haven't done something like this before, so
yeah,
I'm grateful to be asked. When are you coming to Seattle?
I'm going to be in Seattle the first week of September, so I'll see you there.
All right. come have dinner with us.
I'd love to.
Take you to a swimming pool.
Soren came back from his date with you, Jillian, from however many months ago that was, and he was like, I like someone. And it was so clear that he had it was like for the first time, he was like, I have the feelings.
That's so sweet. Oh my God. I love to hear that. Anytime anyone has a crush on me, I love to hear it. So thank you so much.
Yeah. Well, it's the truth. You're a good one, Jillian.
Thank you. Well, thank you guys so much. And thank you everybody for listening to Cruel Summer Book Club. If you like this podcast, please take the time to subscribe and give me a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps me reach more listeners. You can find more of my work at cruelsummerbookclub.substack.com and follow me on Twitter and Instagram @JillaThrilla. I'll see you next week, and take care of your heart.